Welcome everyone to the Supernatural Substation. Today is November 9th, 2018. Remember, this weekend is Veterans Day weekend. I am Bernadine LeBlanc. Your host for tonight, our good friend and host, Aline Pestenio, is on a much needed road trip. Our guest tonight will be joining us shortly. His name is Matthew Swain. We've had him on a couple of times, but that was for Haunted Rock and Roll. Tonight, we're going to be talking about his book, Haunted World War II. Co-hosting with me tonight is our good friend, Peter Haviland. Say hello, Pete.
Hey, how you doing, Bern? It's good to see you. Well, hear from you.
Yeah, thanks for taking my spot for a couple of weeks there. I was kind of in the middle of a move.
Not a problem.
I sure appreciate it. Before our guest joins us, we want to talk a little bit about what he's going to be talking about. I pulled up a website, and it says five places still haunted by a Civil War ghost. And it's the ghostly echoes of America's bloodiest war linger in these five places. I know you have a couple you want to talk about. You want to do that first?
Sure, not a problem. I just remember that, I remember a video on YouTube that had been going around for quite a while. If I'm not mistaken, it was a family that were out videotaping one of the Civil War battlegrounds. And if I'm not mistaken, they caught what looked like soldiers going through the woods and up a hill. And that was kind of fascinating footage for me. We've talked about place memory quite a bit, you know, every time, at least the one I've ever been on here. And, it really doesn't surprise me that, folks see a lot of things out there in the buildings and in the fields, given that, it was so violent and bloody to begin with. I mean, all that energy going into the environment and our psychic selves picking that up. But also, having them removing limbs and burying them on site. And, so having that much of a personal thing that is in the grounds. I don't believe that they excavated all those. I know that they try to excavate them when they find them, but usually they pretty much stay where they are, usually because they're not really mapped out as far as where where they buried all the medical waste. So, I mean, that was one thing, and I don't know what your thoughts are on that as far as what your thoughts were on the video. I mean, I know you can look it up. I think it was on, it's on that old show, I can't even remember it. My brain's just drawing blank, but, you could find it. And the second one was, do you remember the story of the two ladies that were going into a building, into an elevator, and they punched the floor to go up, but some reason the elevator took them downstairs. And when the doors opened, they saw what looked like a medical scene of Civil War soldiers being operated on, and a couple of them reaching out for help and amputations and things like that. It was almost like a time slip. And I always thought that was pretty interesting as well. Do you remember those stories?
No, I don't remember those stories, but it kind of makes me think about the emotions, with all of the Civil War and even the medical, because they didn't have anesthesia back then. So they're kind of cutting limbs off without that. So if you think of all the emotion and,
And the pain
and dramatic.
Oh, yeah. A lot of the times they were liquoring them up and having them bite on sticks and stuff.
I mean, with alcohol, that's it. So, I mean, if you can imagine that, I mean, I would think it would hold a spirit here.
Oh, yeah. And I've even heard stories of folks seeing spirits on the battlefield that look like they're missing limbs, which would make sense, considering, you know, that's the part of, you know, if you're seeing up the part of the person, and if they're missing a limb, then they're not complete. They can only manifest what they know or what they think that they have. So I still think
with the people that have crossed over, even mm-hmm. though they were missing limbs in life, when mm-hmm. they crossed over and people have seen them, mm-hmm. you know, by their bedside or their loved ones, they had their limbs. Mm-hmm. So I would think that if a spirit would be earthbound without the limb,
that
would make sense, because when you go to the other side, you're whole again.
Yeah. You would think. I mean, because I know I've got friends of mine that have, you know, that have missed their missing limbs. They were taken from them, and, you know, they still have phantom pains from where the limb still was. So, I mean, to me, I mean, I would figure that would be our field around us still looking for what's supposed to be there and is not there.
Yeah. That's my thoughts on it, you know, because even if you were blind in life, I've heard, you know, stories of people's loved ones that, and through psychics also and mediums, mm-hmm. that you can see when you go to the other side.
Right.
So that would make sense. We can ask our guest more of, sure. you know, his thoughts on that when he comes on.
Okay. But, so what stories did you have?
Well, I found it's the lineup in 5 places still haunted by Civil War ghosts.
Okay.
And we still have 10 minutes before our guest comes on. But did I send you that link?
Yeah, but I'm having a hard time pulling it up on my phone. Okay. I'm sorry.
Well, that's okay. The first one is the Civil War is still by far the bloodiest war in America's history. An estimated 620,000 Americans lost their lives to 2% of the population at the time. It should be no surprise that so many ghostly legends have their origins in that conflict. The first one is Devil's Den, which is a pretty grisly scene on my end. This collection of boulders on top of a hill in Pennsylvania was called the Devil's Den even before the Battle of Gettysburg. During the war, it earned the nickname of Slaughter Pen because so many men died there. On the second day of the battle, some 8,000 soldiers fought for this hill. At the end of the battle, 3,000 were dead, and a nearby creek literally ran red with blood. Many ghosts are said to haunt the area today, but most famous is a barefoot, shabbily dressed man in a floppy hat who has been known to give directions to startled visitors, pointing and telling them, what you're looking for is over there. So I guess he's maybe pointing to the Devil's Den, which would be maybe the mass grave site.
Maybe. If they went that direction, they pointed, I mean, did it say what they would see?
No. The spirit said, what you're looking for is over there.
Wow.
So it is the shabbily dressed man in a floppy hat who gives directions to startled visitors. The second one is Beauregard Key's house. Confederate General Pierre P.T. What is that, P.T.? Beauregard.
I don't know. I don't know. Private?
Private Beauregard.
I don't know.
Moved into this mansion in New Orleans, French Quarter, in 1865, immediately after the war. It is not just the general himself who is said to haunt the house.
Oh, General Beauregard. Okay.
Yeah. You remember him from New Orleans?
The name sounds familiar. I don't know a whole lot about him, but yeah.
On certain nights, visitors say the Battle of Shiloh is fought once more in the main hall, complete with mangled bodies of men, mules, and horses, and the smell of gunpowder, blood, and death. The Battle of Shiloh in Tennessee was a major battle of the Civil War. It began with a surprise attack by Confederate forces. In the end, General Beauregard was defeated by Union General Ulysses S. Grant. Both sides suffered heavily losses. Mm-hmm. I would see why that would... That would keep spirits around. The house is beautiful, though.
Yeah, and again, you know, heavy place memory. So, yeah, I mean, I can see why people are experiencing stuff there. Wow. Even showing the bodies and stuff, that's pretty intense.
Yeah. And the next one is Fort Monroe. Although Fort Monroe is located in Virginia, this fort was held by Union forces throughout the Civil War. After the war, Confederate President Jefferson David was imprisoned there for 2 years. His ghost is just one of the several said to haunt the fort today. Davis walked the ramparts of the fort daily while he was a prisoner to his wife, who had moved to the house nearby, could get a glimpse of him. He is said to continue his vigil on the ramparts to this day. So, yeah, Fort Monroe. Don't know where that's at. Oh, Virginia. Okay. And we have the White House.
Oh, yeah, the White House has got a lot. Yeah, Lincoln being there as well.
Well, that's whose picture they have up here.
Okay.
The White House.
Yeah, he had a dream of him him being assassinated. If I'm not mistaken, the dream was he walked downstairs to see him lying in state with dollars on his eyes or coins on his eyes.
He had his own premonition.
Yes, he had his own premonition.
Oh wow!
And Mary Todd Lincoln, if I'm not mistaken, was really into spiritualism, and she would have seances there a lot.
Okay. Yeah, I've heard that.
Yeah.
They've had several in the White House. They had Theodore Roosevelt, Maureen Reagan, and Winston Churchill, or other notable guests who reported got a glimpse of Lincoln's ghost.
I can't remember who it was at one point, but I think it was Churchill. I think somebody had just gotten out of the shower or the bath and walked into his room, and Lincoln was there, and they addressed him, and he just dissipated.
Yeah,
I think that's one of the stories I heard.
This last one.
And I think also one time too somebody was knocking on the door, and they opened it up, and he was standing at the door.
Yeah, because Eleanor Roosevelt, the secretary of Eleanor Roosevelt, reportedly ran screaming when she saw Lincoln putting on his boots. Yeah.
I bet that would have been weird to see.
That man must have had some big feet. I have to say, he was tall.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Very much so.
I'm sure they heard him walking around very well in boots.
And I think, too, one of his younger sons had passed, and I think Mary Todd would always try to communicate to try to see if she could talk to him. I don't know how successful she was, but I think the youngest son drowned. I could be wrong. I don't remember how he passed.
I'm not sure.
I don't know if it was drowned or if he died of illness.
So what do you feel about all of these Civil War ghosts before our guest comes on? We still have 3 minutes.
Well, as I mentioned before, you know, place memory is very strong, you know, depending on what our ability is as to what we actually see, my thoughts on it. But yeah, I mean, any historical battle, anything that you gave your life, you know, parts of you and so forth. Yeah. I mean, why wouldn't it be haunted? I've seen
even residual would be, you know, pretty high to me because of in time.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Very much so. Very much so. When they're excavating a lot of these sites and, you know, you start disturbing a lot of the energies in those too, I'm sure the sites get really, really, intense, because you're messing with the energies that are there, but that goes with anything. If you're, renovating a house or, you know, any building in general.
And even digging up mass graves, I would think, you know, would disturb the site, because a lot of places that have mass graves from the Civil War, people don't know where they are.
Well, I mean, I would hate to see what people experienced in World War II in the ovens of Auschwitz and all of the the mass graves that they had pulled those folks out of. I mean, I can just imagine just everything that went on there and what people would experience. It wouldn't surprise me. People running and screaming from that stuff. I mean, that was horrible. And you know, the worst thing that we can do is what we do to each other. It never ceases to amaze me, some of the atrocities that we put on each other. I just wish that would stop.
Yeah, maybe one day, but I don't think so.
Yeah, I don't see it either.
Not the way it looks now.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, well, hopefully our guest can kind of sum up some of these things for us. We've actually had him on twice before for Haunted Rock and Roll. We had a great time with that.
Oh, did you? Okay. I missed that.
The first one, Eileen, I've never heard her talk so much and have, it's like I got one question in. She knew so much about, you know, the old rock and roll and the history of the deaths of the musicians, you know, so she was really excited to do that show.
Oh, cool. Okay.
Oh, yeah. So the second one around, she had just as much fun. I didn't know that much about the deaths of the rockers and the 27 Club and stuff like that. She knew all that stuff. She was one of the old rockers.
I used to play in bands way back in the 90s myself.
Yeah?
Yeah. I was a bass player in a band called Jester.
Jester, that was rock?
Yeah. Yeah, we did original. We did original material. We sounded kind of like a mixture between Metallica and, I would say...
Nat?
Yeah.
Nat, are you there?
I'm here.
Hey, I can hear you. Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you for coming back with us. A little bit different topic this time, but I'm glad. Our guest is with us. Matthew Swain is a journalist who currently works as a research writer at Penn State. He was a regular contributor to the revitalized version of Omni magazine called Omni Reboot. He wrote the Antimatter column, which looked at fringe science and the paranormal, for the online magazine. He has also discussed ghost lore and the unknown on numerous radio shows and podcasts, including Coast to Coast AM and Darkness Radio, balancing skepticism with an open mind. Matt uses his experience in journalism and interest in both ghost lore and the paranormal to collect and tell stories about the supernatural. We've had you on for, we were just talking about that, Haunted Rock and Roll 1 and Haunted Rock and Roll 2. And tonight we have you on for Haunted World War 2. And we were just talking about some of that before you came on. And we have some questions on that, but can you explain to us a little about your book?
Sure. I guess I should explain about how I started to write Haunted World War II, because it feels like a little bit of a departure from the music ghost stories that I've been writing for about, I would say, 5 or 6 years. But it's not that big of a jump, because I love history, and I should say that I really love Civil War history. But when I started to, what I try to do is incorporate, you know, my interest in different historical eras with the supernatural ghost stories and stories of the occult and things like that. But what I did was I started to look into doing a book on ghost stories of Civil War, but I think it's so well covered and people have done such a really good job that I didn't think I could add too much more to the conversation, but I didn't find volumes that covered World War II in the way that I wanted to, which was a much more broader look, more like how I approached more haunted rock and roll. So that's how I got to creating this Haunted World War II. For me, it was a bit of a departure because the material is a little more, well, I would say a lot more serious, more solemn. I didn't have as much chance to write funny one-liners as I did with Haunted Rock and Roll, because Haunted Rock and Roll, at the end of the day, has a lot of fun stories, some silliness involved. You know, I think when you're dealing with rock stars and their super big egos and their, you know, devil may care, it's a little easier to have fun with those stories. But when you're writing about World War II and you're writing about a lot of the great sacrifices, I know Veterans Day is coming up, and so you have a lot more, more of a serious tone to it. So that's kind of how I got to writing about it. My approach to Haunted World War II was to cover, really almost give a general overview of not just ghost stories, but also a lot of tales of curses and synchronicities. And I even have a section or two on UFO stories and Foo Fighters. So it's much more of a compilation of, you know, supernatural weirdness that's going on in World War II and continues to, if you'll excuse the pun, haunt us today.
Yeah, and how many places did you visit of these haunted sites, Civil War sites? Well, did you get to visit many?
You know, in the past, I didn't visit any exclusively for this book to gain any type of material. And there are a few reasons for that I'll get into. But for this book, I've already visited some of the sites there just because of my interest in World War II, like the USS North Carolina is one of them. So I didn't visit that exclusively to try to come up with stories, but I approach these stories more as a journalist. So what I'm trying to do is get other people's experiences and not necessarily my own. I know that there's a whole branch of journalism where you immerse yourself into the environment and then collect those stories. But for me and my background, I try to leave myself out of it, and I try to really go in and find accounts that either people have written about in books, magazines, newspapers, or I reach out to them. I've used a lot in this book. I've used some ghost hunters who have investigated it. And that's kind of two reasons for me is if I go on, and I've never gone on a ghost hunt or any type of investigation like that. I think I've said before that I really don't think I would like the hours. I don't want to be, you know, trolling around a battleship at 3 o'clock in the morning. So that doesn't sound super appealing to me. But the other reason is if I go and nothing happens, then I think that changes how I write. If I go and something happens, I think that changes how I write. And it might help change how I write about it in the future. So when I write these things, it's much easier for me to kind of play, you know, armchair paranormal investigator and play both the skeptic and the believer at the same time. And I think that's what gives my books a little bit more of that journalistic tension.
Right. And did you get a lot of stories of like the World War II guys in the homes or more of the battlefields?
It's definitely more of the battlefields. But now that you mention it, I'm sure there's ghost stories of World War II vets haunting houses and things like that. I think that would make an excellent if I would do a sequel to that, I think that would be interesting about veterans who've come back to certain places back at the States. But what I did was look at battlefields, and really for the first time ever, you have a war that engulfs the whole world globally. And for the first time, you really have not just the conflict occurring on land and sea, but for the first time in air. So my book, I try to divide that up and look at ghost stories on battlefields, Normandy, the Ardennes, the Eastern Front. Some of the islands in the Pacific are pretty haunted, according to stories that made it my way. And then I looked at naval ghost stories, so battleships and aircraft carriers. And then I looked at some anomalous phenomena in the air, such as UFOs, but I also looked at haunted air bases, especially in the UK. And really, for the first time for me, I actually looked at ghosts of objects. For the first time for me, I did a section on ghost planes of World War II. And that is a phenomena that I wasn't really expecting. I kind of have a side story that I'd like to tell you guys about. The ghost planes are, the planes themselves are spirits, not the pilots in it or anything like that. It's that the that especially in the United Kingdom, there have been these sightings after World War II of large bombers that really shouldn't be flying where they're at, coming over highways, and multiple people have seen these over the years since the 40s. So that was kind of new for me. So you not only have land, sea, air, but you also now have this added dimension of haunted objects.
Yeah, I've heard a lot about like the shortwave radio EVPs, like the first EVPs, even on battleships. They've had spirit voices coming through. You think that would be the same as the aircrafts?
Yeah, possibly. I know on the USS North Carolina, there were, in fact, a lot of EVPs collected. But if I can give you an example from my own life, and this is a story that has kind of become part of family lore. And several years ago, and I guess I was just a kid, my mother and my father were going out for a morning walk, and as they left the porch and started walking down the alley, they looked up and there was this huge aircraft. And the way my mother described it, and my father, who was somewhat of a, I would say he was kind of an open-minded skeptic too, said it was a huge plane about the size of a bomber. It passed over in the fog without making much of a noise, and then disappeared into the fog, and we always called that my mom's ghost plane. I guess when you're saying it's like an EVP, it might be a almost like a rehearsal of something that happened in the past. And I mean, I guess that's what a lot of people assume it is in the reports that I read, that it was almost like something that reappeared out of World War II because of the odd thing about it. And the thing that gives it credence to a lot of experts is that the plane that appeared in the one section of the UK called the Dark Peak area appeared to several different people over a certain amount of time. And there wasn't a general pattern to that flight path that would indicate that it was a a regular aircraft. There, the appearance, the way it appeared was scattered throughout that region, and yet it seemed to be at the same altitude and going basically the same direction, but appeared at different places in different ways. So that might be a little more closer to what this idea that it's a reanimation of something that happened in the past.
Pete, do you have any questions?
I'm just listening. It's just fascinating to me. Hi, my name's Pete, Matt, and it's nice to talk with you.
When you were
researching all of this information, what were some of the strangest things that you had come about that might have not made it in the book for some reason, but you found fascinating?
That's actually a great question. And the one that comes up for me time and time again, even as I read it again and as I think about it, is that there's a ghost story about Erwin Rommel, General Erwin Rommel. He was a field marshal known as the Desert Fox. He had some amazing victories in North Africa. He was responsible for building the North Atlantic Wall for Hitler. At the end of his life, there were rumors that he was involved in an assassination attempt on Hitler, so he committed suicide. So there, I was looking for a ghost story about him, and I thought, well, I should maybe search and to see if there are any ghost stories in North Africa. I didn't really find any in Europe or where he was in Normandy. There wasn't any there, but where I did find a few ghost stories, believe it or not, were ghost stories about Field Marshal Erwin Rommel in the United States, in the South, actually, in places like Virginia. Yeah, it amazed me. And the story is, and it's all based on this little bit of war lore, which is that before World War II, after World War I, there was supposedly a secret delegation of German generals who came to the South to investigate the maneuvers of several Civil War generals, Confederate generals, especially Stonewall Jackson. Okay. And the part that's fascinating for me is that there is absolutely no historical record that that ever happened. And so it sounds like more like a rumor. And this, you know, of course, the believers counter and say, well, if it's a secret mission, there's going to be no record. But in any event, there's a inn near where all of this supposedly took place, where people have said they've seen the ghost of Rommel, and they have smelled pipe smoke that they attribute to Rommel. There is a cemetery near that spot too, where people have seen the ghost of a man in a long trench coat, and it sounds like a military style hat, gazing over the graves of a few Confederate generals. And if I'm not mistaken, and I wrote it some time ago, so I'm not sure exactly, but I think it might actually be the descendants of another great general, which would be General George Patton. His descendants were Civil War heroes, and allegedly they've seen this figure near those graves. So that to me was one of those stories, because there's no historical truth that I can find to verify that it actually happened. There were a few moments where I thought, well, I don't know, you know, if I put this in, is this misleading? Am I putting in what I call fake lore? And at the end of the day, I decided it was interesting enough. And I tried to put qualifications in the book to make sure people know that, you know, there's a lot of skepticism about this, but I put it in anyways, because I just found it so darn fascinating. And the other reason is, just like he was in life, Rommel's spirit is kind of elusive too. I couldn't get a good story about him outside of it. So that for me was the one that I didn't expect. I waiver.
No, that's really fascinating.
Yeah, I thought so too, and that's really why I put it in the book.
Wow, that is.
You had mentioned about Foo Fighters and stuff like that. Have you come up, when you were researching, had you come across any? I know that the Flyers were talking about the lights and gremlins and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But have mm-hmm. you come across any of those that were just really out there? I mean, like you could verify it, but I mean, it was just so out there that you didn't know what to think of it.
Yeah,
that makes sense.
A few of those, yeah, totally get you. Yep.
Okay.
There were a few of those, especially the Foo Fighters. There was one that occurred right after the invasion of Normandy, before the breakout. Apparently, now this was a delegation of officers who were out on one of the beaches.
Okay.
This might have been a week or two after the invasion, so there was a lot of chaos. But these officers said that they saw a light going across the English Channel, and initially they thought maybe it was one of those V2 rockets going into England, but they noticed it was going the wrong direction. And we didn't have anything in the Allied arsenal that would explain that. And
right.
the one point I usually make with these Foo Fighters is that you're really dealing with people, observers, who are trained to identify aircraft. And they said that this was not an aircraft that they had, you know, that they could identify in any ways. And it's important to point out that this is a life and death call, because if you are
they'd have to be able to identify it, or else their lives and their comrades' lives were at stake.
Absolutely. And so that was a fascinating one for me. I had heard quite a bit about the Foo Fighter stories of Europe. For example, there was a group of night fighters in Europe, and I think it was 1944 or so, maybe 45 even. But in any event, they had not just one encounter, but it seemed like they were the object of these Foo Fighters' interest over a period of time. And so these night fighters, they are absolutely the best observers, because they're used to observing aircraft not just in the sky, but in the sky at certain speeds and in night. So they are honed on being able to observe exactly what these things are. And they had no clue what it was. And the other fascinating thing I found out about the Foo Fighters is there were also some of those that appeared in the South Pacific. And I was not... I had never heard of that, but I did come across the story of a B-29 encountering a Foo Fighter on their way to a bombing run over Japan.
Had you come across of any of these folks that have dealt with that have seen these Foo Fighters? Was there any reports of any of these aircraft that were damaged by these Foo Fighters that they actually could show that, you know, it shot at me or it scraped me or something?
I did not come across any of those stories. In fact, the way at least one of the reports that I read showed what was going on was that these planes these objects or whatever you want to call them were so agile that they were cutting through formations of bombers. And these bombers were, you know, they were packed in relatively tightly, and yet these objects were able to kind of soar in and out. So at no time did they seem, and I don't want to, you know, and I'm not an expert on this, but at no time do I, in any of the ones that I read, that I feel like they were hostile. I think they scared the bejesus out of the pilots, but I don't think that there were any hostile approaches. If I recall correctly, the one, a lone B-17 bomber flying towards the North Sea, maybe even over the North Sea, said that it was under observation by a Foo Fighter for what it sounded like, you know, miles and multiple minutes, and yet it never made any type of aggressive action. Although I think, if I recall correctly, according to the report, the gunners on the B-17 wanted to engage it. They were starting to get a little afraid.
Okay. And what about, were there any claims of planes being abducted, or people being abducted from the planes themselves when these Foo Fighters started showing up?
I didn't hear any of those stories either. I'm trying to think. So I don't think so.
Okay. Okay. And what about when you were researching some of the when we would invade the beaches, like in Normandy and Iwo Jima and stuff like that? Was there any like haunted recreations of the storming of the beaches that you heard of? I mean, I've never heard of any. I with your research in your book, I was curious to see if maybe if people have seen, you know, the war recreated.
Fascinating kind of story. There was an invasion before Normandy in a beach called, and I'm probably mispronouncing it, but Dieppe, which turned out to be somewhat of an Allied disaster. I think the Allies treated this almost as a practice run to the invasion, and they tried to have a commando raid in this this beach, Dieppe, and everything sort of went awry. The troops and the planes and everything were not coordinated, and it was a bit of a massacre for the Allies. So years after the invasion and years after the war ended, two families from the UK stayed in a house on vacation that was right off of the beach, and they were awoken that night with the sound of what was like horrific gunfire. Then they heard German commands being shouted, and they heard shouts coming from the beaches. They said they went out and checked, and there was nothing there. It had quieted down, and they were actually so afraid they wouldn't go out because they were afraid that there was an actual shooting going on. And then they came back in, and it quieted down, and the next thing they heard was what sounded to be like aircraft going on, and maybe even dive bombers, and completely spooked them enough so that the two of the ladies that were witnesses went to the psychical society that was located in England, based in England.
The SPR, Society of Psychical Research.
You got it. That's exactly what it is. And they reported it to them. And so there was they did an investigation, and what they found was that the timeline that these ladies had reported matched up pretty well with the actual invasion of Dieppe. So that there was a invasion, and then there was this German counterattack on the beach, and then what should have occurred simultaneously, the planes coming in to support, happened later. And so that all matched up with that, what happened. But what you also find is throughout almost all of those beaches in Normandy, and a lot of the beaches, as you mentioned, in the South Pacific, are also haunted. And they are haunted by some of probably the most gripping, in a kind of an emotional sense, ghost stories that I've encountered.
While researching all of this material, what one or two stories that you have did you identify more with?
Well, I identified, and I guess when I say I identified, you know, the part for me that I like is try to come away with something new and something different, and maybe a different take on something that you always you know, considered. And for me, and it, weirdly enough, I'm a, you know, a military history buff, and I like reading about it. And I, you know, I remember watching the, you know, the Sands of Iwo Jima and all of those stories, all those movies. But when I wrote a few of the ghost stories that happened in South Pacific, I just came across with a different stance on you know, what history is, and particularly what military history is, because these, ironically, these ghost stories make history a lot more alive for me. But I'll give you an example. There's a story in Okinawa, and before the Americans invaded Okinawa, Okinawa was one of the last bastions of the Japanese military. And the Japanese military knew that if Okinawa fell, there was a good chance that the Allies would build bases for their bombers, and that pretty much the entire Japanese mainland would be in striking distance, and it would be a great jumping off point for any type of invasion of mainland Japan. So they knew how key this place was. So what they did was they spread rumors among the populace that a American invasion was imminent, and that the Americans had planned to kill, torture, rape the civilians. They had spread this rumor throughout. So right. When the American forces did attack and did land, the GIs reported back about how horrified they were, because I would think that the Japanese military was hoping that the civilians would turn on the Americans and become, you know, a guerrilla outfit. But what happened was that a lot of the civilians ran to the cliffs and jumped off the cliffs and committed suicide. It was just a, you know, kind of a horrific tale. And I honestly never really considered the ramifications of that until I read this ghost story that has occurred quite often, and it is near the Peace Museum in Okinawa. And you know, this story is told multiple times from a lot of different points of view, but basically the story is that these tourists are walking by the Peace Museum out in the fields near these cliffs where the folks committed suicide, and they first hear what's the sound of like footsteps coming behind them, dozens of them. And then they feel a presence, and then they feel a wind pass by them. And then later, seconds later, they hear these anguished cries. So for me, that was just a way to absolutely, that was much deeper emotionally, that connection between that sheer terror of that war and this ghost story. So I think that's one of the ones that that surprised me and changed me.
Wow. Bern, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to take all of your
that's time. Okay. I was just wondering where Joey is, because I guess we're gonna just breeze through the top of the hour break. I can't find him, I guess. Pete made him hungry and he went and eat somewhere.
Yeah. Sorry, Matt. I spun him up before we got on. So he might be doing a Cookie Monster somewhere.
Yeah.
Okay. That's okay.
That's okay. We'll have more time to talk to you, Matt. Me and Pete were talking before you came on about earthbound spirits that people have seen that have missing limbs.
Mm-hmm.
But
that's interesting.
Yeah, because when a spirit passes over, you know, people that we've heard stories from, loved ones, that when they see them, I guess once they've crossed over, they still have their limbs because they're whole again. But the ones that they've seen here, you know, earthbound, lingering around, do not have their limbs. Do you know anything about that? Have you heard any of stories like that?
No, I really haven't heard. I didn't collect any stories for this volume that even touched on any of that, but it is interesting. And, you know, when you're talking about war, especially World War II, there was a lot of, you know, missing limbs and a lot of stories of horrific injuries. So you think that would kind of come up. And I'm scanning through my memory banks now to think if I can even come across one, because, you know, most of the ghost stories that you have about World War II, I don't know whether this extends to the Civil War ghost stories, but a lot of what you come across in World War II is you have a lot of spirits that you can't see, more that you can feel. They're usually ghosts that are anonymous, that you know, not specifically connected to some historical figure. I mean, the majority of those stories are that way, but from all the stories that I came across, they were all completely, you know, embodied.
Yeah, and we were talking about back then, they give them alcohol, you know, just whiskey or whatever, and then cut their limbs off. So yeah. I'm pretty sure, you know, not just residual energy coming down, but I'm sure that a lot of these spirits, because of the way they died, may be stuck here earthbound.
Yeah, I would think that, you know, I think of, there are a lot of theories about why we have ghost stories, why there would be spirits. And that's one of them, is that they die so horrifically, so quickly, that it's such a shock that they never are able to transition. That's definitely one that comes up time and time again.
Yeah, we were also talking about mass graves, because back in the Civil War, you know, I'm pretty sure they had, because of how many people were killed at one time, they'd have mass graves. And that
we
at this time, you know, we don't know where these mass graves are located. So if someone was to excavate them, or, you know, build a house on top, even, I would feel that the spirits would still be there, and that would kind of wake them up, kind of like when you renovate an old house.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of wakes the spirits
possibly.
Up.
Yeah. Hey, and the story that, yeah, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, I was going to ask you, when you researching a lot of these things, I mean, and of course, of all the atrocities that happened in Germany with Auschwitz and all of that, and did you get any stories about anybody that had experienced anything as far as seeing anything or reliving anything out there? I mean, it was so horrible with all the, you know, what happened to all those people. But given that, you know, as we were just talking about, you know, mass graves and things like that, and all the atrocities, I mean, did you find any stories of any hauntings or anybody experiencing things in those places?
That was absolutely going to be the point that I was going to make.
I'm sorry about that.
I'm glad you answered it. It makes me feel like I was on the right path, because I worked with a ghost hunter, one of the more famous ghost hunters in Germany, named Tom Padal. He feels like, to me, he's like the American, you know, the ghost hunters on television that we have. And he was very kind, and we had a sort of an English-German conversation via email and some other social media sites to get some of these stories. And we discussed the ghost stories of some of the concentration camps. And according to Tom, the reports are that they are, you know, extremely haunted, that there are a lot of ghost stories that have filtered back to him, and that he has decided not to investigate out of respect. He really feels like that was one step too far to go with
you know, I have to agree with him. I just was, yeah. I don't think I, me personally, I wouldn't do it either. I just didn't know what you had researched and what you had found.
Yeah, and so I decided not to put any of those stories in the book too. And I I did encounter some outside of what Tom had told me to kind of corroborate what he was saying. But yeah, so those sites are extremely haunted, and I think the mass grave theory that you all were talking about is also pretty applicable.
And as I said, I agree totally with what you had just stated. I think that those folks have suffered enough, and they don't need to have anybody, you know, trampling around out there and bothering them anymore. But like I said, I was just kind of concerned. I didn't know if you had pulled anything that you could discuss.
Right, and they're there, and I think you bring up another interesting point about ghost stories. And since I started writing about these stories, and initially I started writing about the ghost lore of universities, and always when I'm writing these things, in the back of my head, I'm like, why do we tell these stories, and why do they last as long as they do? In the case of some of these university ghost stories, they're over 100 years old. They're, you know, ghost stories in Notre Dame that are 100, 200, you know, 125 years old. And at Penn State, there's one that's now over a century as well. And they're told over and over again. And so why do we do that? And World War II is another case. You know, it's also, you know, nearly a century old, and we're still finding ghost stories and telling ghost stories about those people and those figures. And I think it serves as probably before there were books, and before there were history books, there was this way to preserve history would be through a ghost story. So a certain area has a certain tale, a certain narrative, and you can go there pick up these stories and understand a little bit more. They're not perfect history. But what has happened, I think, in a lot of the Civil War battlefields is you have ghost hunts, and there's more of a commercialization of it. And, you know, some of the history people that I love and respect sort of chafe at that. But on the other hand, I think it is it's one way to I think it might not be perfect history. Ghost stories are not perfect history. They don't tell the whole tale. They might tell it a little off of what it originally was, but I think what it is, it's an opening into history. In my own life, I was at a book signing for my Haunted Rock and Roll, and a lady came up to me and said, you know, I want to tell you, I don't believe any of this crap, but
what?
I love this. Yeah, I love this book, but I now love researching about these rock stars that you wrote about. So she didn't like the ghost stories, but it intrigued her so much that she wanted to learn more about, you know, Janis Joplin and Jimi Hendrix and Jim Morrison. So for me, that's good enough.
Now, speaking about, you know, the different books that you've done, now, as you've done all these different books, and now you're to your book on World War II, have you seen a tying factor to everything that you've written so far?
Yeah, that's another great question. There are some similarities. I would say there's some differences. One thing that I see across the board is this idea of lives that were cut short too soon. You see that in a lot of the stories of the famous rock stars, Jimi Hendrix and Jim Morrison and Brian Jones from the Rolling Stones. But you also see it on these beaches with these young men that were cut down just as they got the prime of their lives. So there's that. So that tends to drive some of these stories. Tragedy also is a similar theme across those genres, and in rock and roll you have the ghost stories surrounding the crash of Buddy Holly in Clear Lake, Iowa. There's also, you know, ghost stories of these air crashes in World War II and the tragedies of on the beaches. So there's that as well. And I, the more I research these and the more I write about this, the more I can't deny that there's something which I usually refer kind of primitively as consciousness raising. There's something about music that raises the consciousness of both the musician and the fan that I think makes them open to supernatural encounters.
And that's interesting.
I think that was one of the big takeaways that I got from writing, you know, three books about it, that there's something to that. When you talk about ghost stories of war, I think just the sheer terror, the sheer adrenaline is where you get the consciousness raising event. That also makes, I think, both probably and you can explore it on a lot of different levels, but I think just even emotionally sharing that kind of terror, even for someone who decades later is in that same space, again makes them open to anomalous encounters.
Wow, that's very interesting. You had also mentioned we were talking about the Foo Fighters and the ghost planes and things like that. What about boats or ships? Has anybody seen any of those boats or ships World War II or wherever the theater was? Has those been reported?
Well, you mentioned this, and now I'm just in the back of my head. I'm like, oh man, I should have looked into that, but. I would guess there are stories.
That's
like
your
that.
Next book.
That could be the next book. I don't think I wrote any of them in this book. What I did write, and I guess why I probably didn't, is that I was writing so much about. So during the war, you have all these battleships and aircraft carriers and other types of ships,
right,
that were used in the war. And after the war, there was this decision, well, now we have this, these old battle wagons, what do we do with it? And luckily, there were some really smart people who decided that they would bring them back to the United States and make them serve as museums. And they have served as this living history. But as I point out in the book, they're also huge in what I would call non-living history, because they have been these centers of paranormal activities. And
the Queen Mary serve as a battleship? I mean, well, not a battleship, but I mean a army, or I think you know what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, I think it was a troop carrier.
Troop carrier.
Yeah, it is, and it is also extremely haunted as well. I don't think I covered that in the book, but the ones I covered were the USS Hornet, which I think has been labeled the most haunted ship in America, and USS North Carolina.
Yeah, I was on the Hornet with Lloyd Auerbach and Dr. Heath and all of that. I experienced something. I experienced somebody in one of the bunks out there.
Pretty
interesting. I'm sorry?
So Lloyd Auerbach was the one who coined that phrase, as I remember it. So you
were did he? Okay.
With him?
Okay.
Did you go on a ghost hunt with him, or?
I was invited out to a conference with him, and we were discussing the paranormal work that was going on, and I think we ended up forming a group called the Paranormal Research Organization with the 15 or 20 people that he invited up. And he took us on the Hornet, and we heard some stories about it, and we got to walk it just by ourselves. I mean, we were like 15 or 20 of us. We had the Hornet for as long as we wanted it, and I was through, and I had heard what sounded like something tapping on one of the bunks, and walked over there to kind of look at it. And I mean, you could just feel somebody there. I mean, you just know it when you feel it. Mm-hmm. And it was pretty interesting. And I had one of the mediums was there, was telling me that there was somebody there that was playing cards on the bunk.
Wow. Yeah.
And those bunks are very small, aren't they?
Yeah, they are. They're very small.
Interesting. Those are a lot of the stories that have come my way. And you asked, I believe, earlier about my personal experiences. And when I was on the USS North Carolina, now I didn't see anything, but I'll tell you, when you're in those areas, the type of, first of all, you're just amazed at how huge it is. And you're also amazed at how this floating city existed. And you're also amazed at how these people, you know, the sacrifices they made and the emotional intensity they must have gone through. And with the North Carolina, if I'm not mistaken, was the one where there was one, and I don't know whether it was North Carolina, but I think it was, that was torpedoed, and they had to shut one section of the ship down and had to lock it down so the water would remain in those areas and not escape into other parts of the ship. And as they did, they realized that there were live sailors, you know, and they could hear the water,
that's heartbreaking to hear that.
It was rising higher and higher, and they were banging to get out, and they could not let them out. So you can imagine what that story does to people in those areas, and feeling that kind of intensity. So those stories are pretty, they're not rare.
Have you heard any stories from Pearl Harbor?
Pearl Harbor is probably one of the most haunted spots in World War II history in the United States. And those ghost stories run the gamut of, types of stories that you usually hear within the, haunted lore. So there's one kind of a really sad ghost story. And that is that there was a sailor aboard the USS Arizona who, shortly before the attack on December 7th, 1941, left his watch to go on shore just for a moment. I don't know, what the reason was, and never made it back in time. The attack happened, and the ship was sunk, and of course, all his comrades went down. And there's this ghost story of every once in a while on a foggy morning in Pearl Harbor, you'll see this lone, solemn figure hidden much in the mist, looking out onto the sea. And the story is that's that sailor returning to his watch that he was never able to make. The other stories are one lady took a picture of the USS Arizona Memorial, or rather the water right next to it. You can see faces in the waves. So the stories surrounding the base itself, surrounding Pearl Harbor, are actually very haunted too. There was I think it's Wickham Air Base had a building that was so haunted that the guards, they used to have what's called CQ. The CQ desk is usually in the building itself. And this building apparently was so haunted that they moved the desk outside. So a lot of interesting stories there.
What were they experiencing that they had to move the desk outside?
Well, one of the things that, I might be confusing some of the bases there, but one of the places was used as a morgue.
Okay.
And at around the time that the attack happened, the steps of this one section of the building would start to shake. And then it would shake more and more and more. And then finally, it was almost like there was some type of earthquake. But the way they describe it is like 100 people coming down those steps. And the other thing that would happen is that the alarm system would turn on at the same time in the morning, usually I think 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, and it had happened with such regularity that the standard operating procedure would be that the security crew would come in and check every nook and cranny of this building to make sure that someone didn't come in and wasn't trying to burglarize or steal something or hurt somebody. But it happened so regularly that the security team would just go in and shut off the alarm and leave because they didn't want to deal with it. So then there were some other stories of just, especially in this place, that there was the morgue, was the smell. The smell would get so bad, it would smell like, rotting flesh.
Oh, man. Wow. Yeah. You still there, Vern?
Oh, yeah, I'm here. Y'all doing okay? Good. You have some interesting questions, Pete.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
Yeah. I don't know too much about the war, but I have one question. It's kind of different, maybe for your next book also. During the Civil War, sometimes when people were, in the historical homes and stuff, the plantation homes and what have you, the family of the soldiers, some reported their loved one that died on the battlefield would actually come to them, like at the front door, like they were actually coming home. Mm-hmm. But then they would disappear, and then someone else would show up to tell them that their loved one had passed away. So they actually came to tell their loved one, before they even knew that they had died. Before the family knew they died, they seen the soldier.
Well, that's interesting that you brought that up, because in World War II, or this would actually be after World War II, General Patton was involved in a Jeep crash, and then then died later in the hospital. And both his daughters reported that in one way or another, their father appeared to them almost at the same moment that he died. One received a bizarre phone call from her father, and it was a transatlantic type of call, and she had received those before, and so she knew what it was. And the voice on the other side was General Patton, who was talking, and I can't remember the exact dialogue, but had talked with her, and then mysteriously hung up. And so she tried to get back on the line, and the operator said there had been no transatlantic call made from her father that night. His other daughter said that her father appeared at the end of her bed the night that he died. So those types of stories do appear in World War II history. And in fact, to some of the most famous figures of World War II history.
Wow.
Oh.
You had mentioned too about, I think you mentioned something about items. So have you any while you're researching, any stories on items or relics or museums that have had any issues of activity or visions or anything like that from dealing from some of these wars?
Yeah, there are really dozens of those types of stories, especially. As now that I'm thinking about it, a lot of the air museums in the United Kingdom and in the United States have pieces and also objects and also these planes that were actual vintage World War II aircraft on display. And the one that I'm thinking about is I think there was a bomber involved in World War II, and I believe it was a B-24 the crew was involved in a attack on a base in Libya, and they overshot the mark, and ended up going deep into the desert where they crash landed. And they didn't find this wreckage until years later. And again, it was this sad story. They found some of the crew at the bomber itself, and then they found some of the crew who looked like they were must have been on a rescue mission to try to go out and find water and bring it back, or to try to find help and bring it back. In any event, they didn't make it, and they perished as well. But there were parts of the plane that were okay, and mm-hmm. so they used them on other planes. And apparently, those planes were victims of mysterious accidents as well. It almost reminds you of James Dean's cursed Porsche. So they have some of those on display. And if I'm correct, I think it's at the United States Air Force Museum in Dayton, Ohio. And reportedly, there's all types of paranormal action around that site. And there are other displays out there. There's one, I think, of the B-29 boxcar. And that, apparently, there is a story that there is the ghost of a young Japanese boy who's been seen around the B-29. And of course, boxcar dropped one of the final atom bombs of the war. So that
he's
connected to a victim. No, this was the second one. I think this was Nagasaki.
Boxcar
carried that. So they have this story, and it appears that the Japanese boy might be one of the victims. And there are other stories of, in England, there's a really funny, kind of one of the more heartwarming stories is that there's a one museum, and a couple of they were restoring a plane in the museum, and saw one of the crew members saw a crisply uniformed, crisply walking airman walk right to the plane, and then promptly disappear. His mate was inside the plane, working in the plane. And he told his friend, you know, I saw this ghost. And the guy said, you're crazy. And then the next day he saw it. There's a story mm-hmm. that the workers were up on a ladder. One of them fell off, and about halfway down, right before he was going to plummet and crash into the ground, he said he felt lifted up and it's like someone caught him and laid him gently down.
Oh,
and then
wow.
a few years later, there's a story that these people concocted the story because they wanted to make sure they were going to move this plane to another museum, and they loved it so much they wanted to keep it. So they created this ghost story. And then there mm-hmm. were counter stories that came along that said, no, that wasn't true, that these things actually did happen. So that's a little bit of the kind of fun give and take that you have with some of these stories.
Wow. That's so unusual for somebody to report that they were helped like that. I'm glad it happened.
I've never
going back to Pearl Harbor. Has anybody seen any of the any kamikazes? Flying around or hearing them or anything? Hmm. I mean, since it was such a violent confrontation.
Yeah, you would think that would be one of the stories that comes out, especially with that theory about emotional intensity of these events.
Yeah, exactly.
So I can't recall of any of those, but it does seem in my memory, I think I do recall not the ghost of any kamikaze, but I think there was one story that I wrote about one of the boats that was involved in a kamikaze attack. So possibly that might be related. So that's another interesting one.
Oh, okay. A little off topic. I just like to hear mm-hmm. what you get, get what your thoughts are. What are your thoughts on Flight 19?
Flight 19.
Squadron that was that disappeared over Bermuda Triangle.
Yeah, you know, did that occur during the war too, correct?
I think it did. I mean, I don't recall the exact date.
Yeah, it's one of those ones that I think I should have used in the book, but I don't know. I don't think, to me, it's just so, you know, accidents happen. Mishaps happen. Even the best pilot is going to have a bad day.
Right.
But when you look at Flight 19, the entire flight, it would be very hard for me to think that all of those pilots would have made the same mistake at the same time and not tried to correct it. You know, so to me, I think that's still one of the great unknowns. And so,
well, they also lost what they called a Dumbo. That was one of the big planes that went out to search for them. Yeah. They lost one of those too.
Yeah. And I think, was there a ship that was involved too, that sunk? I don't remember.
Yeah. I remember that they said that there was a ship out there that, they caught some of the communications between the pilots. But mm-hmm. I don't remember exactly what had happened with that.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Fascinating. And generally what happens when I write these is I fluctuate between being a skeptic to believer, maybe back to skeptic, maybe back to believer. Mm-hmm. I'll go through that as I'm writing and even editing. And I'm always coming up with ways. And so I didn't do Flight 19, but I will tell you that prior to writing this, I had always had a pretty open mind with the Philadelphia experiment.
That's always gotten me too.
Yeah. So after I wrote this book, I do think it might have been related to, there was one piece of information that I came across, and of course, I'm sure experts on it already knew this, but they were doing experiments in that area to make ships invisible to torpedoes. And so in my mind, I could think how that gets passed. When I see a lot of these ghost stories, you can feel like, and I see this especially with the university ghost stories, is every generation adds a little bit, takes a little bit away, adds a twist. And it's an evolving narrative. And I think that maybe that's what happened with the Philadelphia experiment, is it started out very small and it was about using high technology to make it invisible to torpedoes. Somehow the idea of torpedoes dropped off, and soon they were talking about making the ship invisible, and then it adds
technically from that. You can make it invisible if you take it off of a radar. If you can't see it, then it's not there.
Exactly. And I think that's right. And then I think from that point on, they were talking about teleportation and things like that. So I came away from that not really believing that there was anything more to it than that.
Yeah, I have to agree with you on that. I mean, didn't they claim that somebody had seen it show up at another port, and then it disappeared from that port? And
yeah.
Came back to the original port. I just find that very hard to believe.
Yeah.
It is interesting, though. It's an interesting story. And I guess a lot of stories in the folklore, there's a lot of truth to them somewhere. I mean, because they have to start somewhere.
Right. I think that's even the point that I make quite a bit, is that, you know, even if tomorrow you would come and absolutely say, none of this is real, none of this could ever be real, I would still go on writing about it, because I find a lot of the lessons, you don't have to believe in the supernatural at all to take away some value of this, whether it's some of these ghost stories serve as cautionary tales. Some of these stories that we just talked about are interesting case studies and how rumors happen and evolve, and how people before the internet might have had their own kind of internet and their own kind of social media that we would call ghost stories that linger and change, and you know, people alter the truth. And so I find them fascinating just for that reason.
Well, let me ask you this. You've also referenced your rock and roll books a couple of times. Mm-hmm. Have you gotten any other stories that you haven't heard about from the people contacting you and giving you a story or a report of a haunting or something that you hadn't included in any of the books because you've just now received them?
Yeah, this show gives me stories all the time that I had no idea. the Johnny Thunder one that mm-hmm. those folks have investigated are so interesting. And I firmly believe that after writing two books on rock and roll and one book on country music, that I don't think I've even touched the surface of it. And other stories are appearing all the time that I like to explore, because I started out really just wanting to write about the ghost stories of rock and roll. But as I got into it deeper, and especially after reading like our Gary Patterson, who is kind of my hero with Take a Walk on the Dark Side, he gets into more of the legends, the occult legends, the mm-hmm. Robert Johnsons, the Led Zeppelin.
Oh man, that story, Robert Johnson, that's just creepy, isn't it?
Yeah, and the more that I'm investigating that, the more I'm starting to see other similar stories starting to appear. In my latest book, I looked at, you know, what's being called the grunge curse. Is this propensity for lead singers and frontmen of grunge era bands to die, not mysteriously, but they have all died. There have been so many of them, especially from that Seattle sound. I think Eddie Vedder.
Oh yeah, Chester and the guy from Soundgarden. They were friends.
Yep.
Didn't they die like about a week or 2 weeks apart?
I think so. And then you have Kurt Cobain, and there was the lead singer from Mother Love.
I've heard a lot of people report about Cobain that they really think it was his wife that contracted that one out.
Yeah, I came across that too. I that's the other fascinating thing about rock and roll lore, is then you have a lot of these rock and roll conspiracy theories too that I don't really get into quite a bit, but I think there's enough for a book right there.
Oh yeah.
Well,
especially how they found his body. I mean, I don't think you could actually shoot yourself the way that they say that the gun was compared to where his body was. I mean, I just find that weird.
Mm. Yeah. I don't know enough to comment, but I certainly have heard people say similar things. But you know, you have Elvis is still alive. Was Brian,
yeah, didn't they
Jim
say something
killed?
About that they had a picture thinking that he might have been the gardener now or something on Graceland?
Yeah, there's that. And when I was writing these Elvis ghost stories, for me it was kind of pretty hairy, because on one hand you have people who say they've seen Elvis's ghost. You have people who say they've seen Elvis as a gardener or a guy working at Burger King. And then you have people who dress like Elvis and act like Elvis, the impersonators and the tribute acts. And then you have his entire staff, the Memphis Mafia, who dress like him, look like him, talk like him, wore the same mm-hmm. sunglasses. So you'd never really know.
Have plastic surgery to look like him.
Yep. And then you'd never really know whether this is a ghost story or this is just someone who misidentified, one of his friends walking by the pool house. So I find that fascinating, but it's also pretty confusing.
How about, Paul McCartney having died in that car wreck? And they brought in somebody was named Billy Shear or Billy something.
Yep.
I don't remember the guy's name.
but something about facial reconstruction and all that other weird stuff. I mean, that's just weird too.
Right. And if you're interested in that, Art Gary Patterson's Take a Walk on the Dark Side is the book for you. And I really believe that if Art Gary was still around with us today, he would be maybe writing about the Kurt Cobain conspiracy. This was a guy who could, he was sort of a triple threat. He was a good writer. He was a really good reporter. And he was also a wonderful storyteller. So I would have loved to see what he could do with some of those stories.
That would be interesting. Did you?
Yeah.
Are you familiar with D. Scott Rogo?
That name sounds familiar.
He wrote on haunted houses and stuff like that back in the late 70s, early 80s. And for the longest time, he was found murdered in his home. And for the longest time, they couldn't find who did it. And I think just within the last 10 years, I finally found out who had killed him. You might want to look into that. It's a pretty interesting story.
I will definitely check that out. What was his name again?
His name is D. Scott Rogo, R-O-G-O.
Okay, I've heard that name. I must have read his stuff.
Yeah, you'd probably recognize him if you saw him or some of the books that he's written.
Okay, good.
Well, Matt, sounds like you have some more books to write.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, I come on this show to promote my books, and I end up having more to write.
Hey, that's why you have to take notes on our show.
I know.
Okay. Well, we're almost at the end of our show, and we would like to thank you for being our guest. And if our listeners want to find you or your books, can you give us the information on how to do that?
Yeah, I have a website. It's mattswayne.com, mattswayne.com. And please, if you can, if you'd want to buy the book, go on Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com, or visit your local bookstore. And if it isn't in, ask them to bring it in. And also, if you like the book, if you could give me a good review on Amazon. If you didn't like it, if you could just email me and yell at me that way.
Yeah. Hopefully you don't get that email.
I thank you for being with us tonight, Matt. I really enjoyed speaking with you.
Well, thank you, and I really appreciated your questions. Were very insightful, and I appreciate them.
Well, thank you.
When you get them new books out, let us know, and we'll have you back on as our guest again.
Okay, that sounds great.
Looking forward to it.
Righto. See you later. Thank you.
Bye, Matt.
Bye.
He's so awesome.
Yeah, I like him. He's a nice guy. I'm gonna have to get his books and start looking at it.
Yeah, this is the third time we've had him on the show. It's very interesting. So hopefully he gets some good insight. And like he said, when he's on our show, I told him take notes because we'll give you. We'll always give you some good titles out there, more information, more books. Yeah, we like Matt Swain. But we're coming up against the end of the show. So, Pete.
Yes, ma'am.
I think my thing's about to die here. So if I lose you, I'm going to close out the show.
Okay.
And what can happen is we'll talk until my thing dies. Sorry about that. We're having technical difficulties because of my internet. I just moved. So we just set it up today. But that wraps up another Supernatural Substation. And Pete, if they want to find you, where would all our listeners find you?
Yes, they can find me at lsspi.org and redoakhypnosis.com.
Cool. Cool. And if you need to find me, I'm on Facebook under Bernadine LeBlanc. And also my website is lspr-society.com. And if you're looking for Aline and her book, she is also on Facebook and her website, Aline Pestanio.com.